Thanks. Okay, while this is starting up, so it's a real pleasure to be here talking on this special day for Steve. I guess we're all supposed to have some story about Steve, and I, you know, anything I say would probably be apocryphal, but I think this is actually true, if my memory serves right. So the first time I met Steve, I was introduced to him at one of these get-togethers at some conference, and I think he probably, you know, it was one of those things with lots of wine and beer and so on. And I was just a graduate student at that time, finishing up, and Steve came up to me and reminded me very much of this movie that I remembered from my undergraduate days. You know, he said, so I hear that you want to be a condensed matter physicist, and I said, yeah. He says, I have two words for you, magnetic polarons. And, you know, that's how I met Steve. Anyway, I really don't know if that's true of my memory, it's just making things up. So anyway, it's fun to be here talking about magnetic semiconductors. And I'm going to talk, here's the outline, if I can get this thing working. No? Okay. What's going on now? Yeah, okay. So I'll first just go through a brief look back at an introduction to transport and magnetism in magnetic semiconductors. And the main thing I want to do is sort of point out that you know, there's a lot of this early work by Steve that really got many of us interested in this field. And then I'll go on to talk about spin control in gallium manganese arsenide via a couple of techniques, then listed my collaborators up there, and then finish off with some recent work on the anomalous Hall effect in magnetic 2D electron gases. So these are systems that we've studied for a long time, but they seem to be generating some interesting new physics that we hadn't thought about before. So just a brief look back. I mean, this is one of the you know, classic early papers that that Steve published, where by using transport measurements, you know, he really came up with interpretations of transport in terms of these objects that came to be called as magnetic polarons. And those of you who study CMR manganites and study gallium manganese arsenide and so on will recognize this very familiar kind of peak in the resistivity that we see in many of these ferromagnetic semiconductors. Well, you know, once these ideas came about interpreting transport in terms of magnetic polarons, then other people like when David joined IBM and so on, they got interested in trying to look at the development of these magnetic polarons more directly. And in this first example of using a sort of pump probe technique, a time resolve technique, optical technique to look at the development of magnetic polarons, I think this was one of the first pieces of direct evidence about how magnetic polarons develop in time and decay and so on. And that's when I started getting interested in this area, having just finished graduate school. And I was really interested in these two manganese 6 materials. And the two manganese 6 materials are interesting because when you put manganese into a 2-6 lattice, you know, the manganese is isoelectronic. And since the manganese is isoelectronic, it's a very nice clean system to look at. And in the last decade or so, we've been able to develop many high-quality quantum structures. And the key idea is that the ST and PD exchange leads to giant Zeeman splitting and also magnetic polarons. And one of the first experiments that I got involved in this context was the idea of David's idea of trying to use quantum structures in highly sensitive microsusceptometers. And so this was a particular kind of staggered band alignment quantum structure that I developed at that time in order to just locate electrons in a confining quantum well in very close contact with magnetic ions and exclude all the holes from this area. And then when David and Mark Freeman pumped this with circularly polarized light in a squid, you saw this very remarkable data, which was indicative of the formation of magnetic polarons. And not only that, but you could see quantum confinement effects in this kind of a system associated with magnetic polarons. So this is a very, very direct kind of measurement. And from that point onwards, we also got interested in then trying to develop structures in which you could measure transport in two-dimensional systems where electrons interact with magnetic ions. And my first graduate student who developed these magnetic 2-degs generated some really interesting kind of data. Look at this. This is a highly disordered magnetic 2D electron gas. It's highly disordered simply because it's at a very low carrier density, so that you don't screen the disorder. At low fields, at zero field, you essentially have a strongly localized 2D electron gas. You put a magnetic field on, and you go from H over E squared, roughly, of sheet resistance to something like 40 H over E squared in a field of about a couple of kiloersteds. And then, bang, after that, you go into a quantum Hall transition. And, you know, it's a very remarkable kind of system. And we've been able to show in this paper that this was really due to spin-dependent localization in this disordered system. So these type of systems, of course, then, over the last decade or so, we've been able to develop a lot of sophistication in terms of fabricating these types of materials. And we've been basically focusing on magnetic materials with well-established growth and processing protocols. And the reason for that is because since you don't have to reinvent the wheel in terms of processing, you can make a variety of interesting structures. So, for example, this is a gallium manganese arsenide microdisc in which you can take a ferromagnetic system, put it inside an optical microcavity, and try to couple light with the magnetic ions in this magnetic microcavity. These are structures that were developed in a collaboration between David's group and mine, and these are these nice magnetic cantilevers that Jack Harris developed here. Here is a structure that I'll mention a little bit briefly later on in this talk, where we take gallium manganese arsenide and try to make lateral spin valves out of these things. And then this is still not a working device, but this is a collaboration between David Goldhaber and me where we've tried to take magnetic 2-degs and then develop quantum dots in these spin-polarized 2-degs. So there's a variety of different kinds of processing that one can do in order to... like I said, it's a template. In other words, the gates, of course, there are many technical issues with gating and ohmic contacts and so on with these systems, the first thing that I want to talk about then is spin control in patterned gallium manganese arsenide devices. And just to remind you again, Steve is everywhere. So this was the first paper on diluted magnetic 3-5 semiconductors. And Steve was one of the big champions of this at IBM. Of course, this was the work done by Hiro Munekata and Hideo Ono, along with Steve and others. So just a reminder about gallium manganese arsenide. I think you've heard about this already this week, but you know that it's a zinc blend material in which the manganese goes substitutionally for gallium. Unfortunately, that's not the end of the story. A lot of the manganese, when you grow this system by MBE, goes interstitially. And then there are also defects like this, arsenic antisites. So these defects in gallium manganese arsenide essentially limit the kind of Curie temperatures that you can get in as-grown material, and where the TC is limited to about 110 Kelvin or so. But many of us, and this was work that I did with Peter Schiffer at Penn State, but many people around in this community have found out that if you anneal these samples after you make them, then you can improve the Curie temperatures and you can improve the homogeneity of the magnetic aspects of the material and so on. So, for example, this is magnetization versus temperature. The as-grown sample has this magnetization curve over here, a very weird and disordered kind of magnetization. And after annealing, you get a nice mean field-like behavior with a TC. In this case, this was one of the early samples of 110 Kelvin. So this looks very nice. And you wonder then, this is what we're doing. We're making these epi layers like this. We can now make nice devices with Curie temperatures above 110 Kelvin. As I say, we can go up to 170. So is this really true? Well, unfortunately not, because the problem is that the minute you make a quote, useful device in which the gallium manganese arsenide is buried underneath the surface, this annealing does not work anymore. So if you just put even 10 monolayers of gallium arsenide on top of a simple structure like this, and then you carry out the annealing, look what happens. this is before and after annealing, the Curie temperature does not budge. And so this was a problem for us, and we're trying to figure out whether there was a solution to this. Well, one of the reasons that this annealing actually works in samples like this is that it's been found out by many people that what's happening essentially is that these manganese interstitial defects, which are compensating for the holes, they go to the free surface, and then they get compensated themselves over there. So we came up with a very simple idea. What if you make a heterostructure, but now just nanopattern it? You know, so you give additional free surface in the lateral region, and is that going to then increase the Curie temperature? So we tried that, and indeed it actually works. So we made wires like this by e-beam lithography and reactive ion etching. Here is a 1 micron diameter wire. Here's a 70 nanometer wire. This is the 4-probe resistance as a function of temperature. The peak in the resistivity, as you saw from that very early data from Steve, correlates with the Curie temperature. And in the 1 micron wire, the annealed and as grown, as you can see, there's very little change in TC. But in the 70 nanometer wire, for example, there's a large change in TC. So clearly, there are imaginative ways in which one can get around this problem, of nanoengineering the diffusion pathways for defects. And if you now look at the Curie temperature as a function of annealing time for many different wires, you can see that there is very systematic behavior in terms of the way the Curie temperature changes with annealing time. There's very little physics in this, unfortunately. I mean, there's a little bit of physics that you might imagine trying to model whether this lateral interstitial diffusion can be modeled by using some simple 1D diffusion model. And we've tried doing that, but so far, at least a 1D diffusion model in which if you were to measure the conductivity of the wire and measure d sigma by dt as a function of the annealing time, and try to plot that and see whether it scales as a simple function like this, it turns out that 1D diffusion models do not explain the data, at least in our nanowires case. So nanoengineering, one normally thinks about doing nanopatterning and measuring wires and so on for doing mesoscopic physics or exploring a variety of different physical issues. It turns out in this case, it's actually useful for just materials engineering. And so that's one of the messages that I wanted to get across. We're also using lateral patterning for other types of studies. One of the ideas that Michael Platte and Giovanni Vignale proposed some time ago was the idea of a unipolar spin transistor. So supposing you make a 3-element device like this, where you have a magnetization that points in one direction here, opposite direction here, and the same direction as here over here. So can you make a device like this? Well, in order to look at devices like this, you want to have control over the switching fields over these different regions. You want to control where the domain walls are located and so on. And so we tried to look at that by making devices of this sort, by making devices like this. And, we've used e-beam lithography to make a number of devices. We've made tens of devices of this sort where you have gallium manganese arsenide with different shapes and they're connected by regions like this. And our idea was simply to try to probe. Can we pin domain walls? Can we measure some kind of lateral spin valve effect and so on? And at first sight, the data looks interesting. If you make a device like this and say you measure the lateral resistance between a notch over here, then you get something that looks like spin valve behavior. So you get a jump in resistance when one of these elements switches, and then you get a jump in resistance again when they line up in the same direction. But a dead giveaway over here is that the data here is antisymmetric in magnetic field. And essentially, all that is happening over here is that you are measuring essentially a Hall effect contribution or an anomalous Hall effect contribution to rho xx. And you can model this in more sophisticated ways using circulating currents and so on. But, if you show this to an undergraduate student and ask them what's the potential difference between this point and this point, if you have an electric field that's transverse and in opposite directions in these two regions, they can easily argue that you get exactly the data that you show over here. And in fact, if you look at the resistance between D and E and A and B, you find that they are mirror images of each other. Okay. But nonetheless, I think this provides an interesting way in which you can probe the location or the pinning of domain walls. So we've used this kind of technique of detecting the pinned domain walls to also look at devices of the sort that Hideo Ono talked about earlier this week. And we've made these devices exactly in the same way that Hideo Ono described on Monday. I wasn't here, but this is the stuff that he's already published in several papers. And the idea is that you make a gallium manganese arsenide device with perpendicular to the plane anisotropy, and then you make step edges by wet etching to different depths. If you now measure the resistance between A and C, so that's the resistance between this one and this one, and if you control the edge depths properly, then you can show for yourself that you can set up an alignment of the magnetization of the kind shown over here. And now the reason for doing this kind of magnetic domain wall pinning is to see if you can manipulate the magnetic domain walls using a pulse current. And so we've done that, and in this case, just a few devices, and we've got this working. This red curve over here shows the anomalous Hall effect measured across E and B, and the other two, the green and the blue, show the anomalous Hall effect measured across these islands. And so in this case, this is at 70 Kelvin. I forgot to write the here's the current density. The typical current densities at which you can achieve switching of this sort are around 2 times 10 to the 4 amps per square centimeter. So we've been playing around with these types of devices, and clearly there are you can see that at low currents. In this case, this is a 50 microamp pulse. The pulses come in opposite directions, and I already gave you the details about the 100 millisecond wide pulses, and they're separated by about 20 seconds or thereabouts. So at a low current, you don't see any manipulation of the domain walls at all. If you go to higher currents, then you start seeing this manipulation of the domain walls. One of the interesting things that we have noticed in many of our devices is that we often can achieve conditions in which the domain wall behavior or the manipulation is almost like a diode. In other words, it looks like, depending on the processing, you can get different domain wall pinning energies or potentials at these two different edges. So that if you set up a condition where you're trying to drive a domain wall like this or in the opposite direction, there are different threshold currents for which direction you're trying to drive the domain wall in. So this raises some interesting ideas that one could build if one could control this in some way. Right now we can't really control it. It's a random function of processing. But if one could control this in some way, then you can imagine making interesting domain wall type diodes. So in the remaining, 3 minutes, I don't know, I'm going to just briefly mention some new results that are coming out from these paramagnetic 2-degs. And this is work that's been done in collaboration with David Goldhaber Gordon and really has been pushed by John Cummings, who was a postdoc with him and took up this idea. As I mentioned, David and I were interested in trying to take these magnetic 2-degs and make quantum dots out of them. So John Cummings invested a lot of time and got the ohmic contacting schemes to be much more consistent and better than my students had done. He got the gating to be much better. Never was able to make quantum dots because this is not gallium arsenide. But he did notice something different and interesting. And I just want to point out that, this something that is different and interesting has been in our data for a long time. We just sort of ignored it or called it an artifact because we weren't, I wasn't sure that it wasn't an experimental artifact. If you look at a magnetic 2-deg, look at this quantum Hall effect, and you don't have to worry about all the details. It's essentially a quantum Hall effect in a completely spin-polarized 2D electron gas. And it's completely spin-polarized from very low fields. You notice that there is something wrong with this picture. Can someone say what's wrong with this picture? Exactly. I mean, if you extrapolate the low field Hall effect, it should go through the centers of these plateaus, and it doesn't. So it's sort of indicating, and we've gone back and looked at all our data of the last decade, and every single sample has this kind of behavior, that there is an excess Hall slope. There is an excess Hall coefficient at low fields. And this is what John noticed, and because he had got the contacts working so that he could do AC measurements and very careful measurements, he started to look at this in more detail. And he's measured this excess Hall slope. He's measured the Hall slope as a function of temperature and finds that as you go to lower temperatures, this Hall coefficient increases, as shown over here. It seems to suggest an anomalous Hall effect in these samples. And we've done the measurements of the magnetization indirectly to see whether it scales with the magnetization. In other words, this anomalous Hall effect should scale with magnetization, which should go as a Brillouin function like this. And you clearly see that these are optical data taken by Scott Crooker, and you can see that the anomalous Hall effect and the Zeeman shift scale in similar ways. You can put a gate on top of this, which John did, and you can study the this anomalous Hall effect as a function of the gate voltage or as a function of carrier density. And we've looked at this in great detail. And since I'm running out of time, I'm just going to give you the bottom line. The bottom line is that using traditional ideas of anomalous Hall effect, you would expect to see some contribution from skew scattering, some contribution from side jump possibly. And if we look at our particular samples, these are based on zinc selenide. The spin orbit coupling is negative. That's one thing that we need to take account of. The second thing is that the magnitude of the spin orbit coupling is at about a tenth the value of in gallium arsenide. So it's very surprising that we even see something that resembles an anomalous Hall effect. And from the fact that the anomalous Hall effect is an excess positive value, in other words, the excess Hall coefficient is positive, we think we can rule out the side jump, and it must be corresponding to spin, to skew scattering with a negative potential here, scattering potential. But if that's the case, then the anomalous Hall effect should scale linearly with rho xx. And I don't have time to show you in detail, go back to all the other previous graphs and show you, but if you just look at any particular temperature and you look at the change in rho xx as a function of gate voltage, you find that rho xx increases very steeply as you deplete the 2D electron gas. And that's simply because you're killing screening. And so, you know, there's a great deal of localization taking place, but the anomalous Hall effect contribution only increases by a factor of 2, and this increases by like a factor of 10. So it's not scaling linearly with rho xx. John has made some arguments that in some sense we are, you know, we really don't know where to go, so we are grasping at straws, and we've tried to extract a classical value of the resistance from these rho xx versus temperature curves. And you know, and one could argue that the anomalous Hall effect sort of scales with this rho classical, but that's just a conjecture that we are trying to pull out from our data. So let me finish here and just summarize what I've been talking about. I hope I've been able to give you some overview of the kinds of things that we are doing with transport in magnetic semiconductor systems, and I hope to have shown you that micro and nano patterning allows us some systematic control over the magnetic properties via defect diffusion engineering and domain wall manipulation. And over the next month or so, hopefully we'll have cleared up and got more data on many more devices so that I can confidently give some temperature-dependent information about domain wall manipulation, and that might be useful. And in these magnetic 2 degs, I think we have some interesting something interesting going on that we would like to understand. So thanks very much for the attention, and again, pleasure speaking here for Steve's symposium. I mean, one would expect that it would scale as rho xx, right?
With rho xx varying, the temperature is being
fixed. Right.
But the temperature...
Well, so what we did essentially was gate the sample.
Yeah.
And vary hence the... I mean, you can either look at the rho xx varying as a function of temperature or even at a fixed gate voltage. You can look at its variation. That's true, and perhaps we are taking just a very naive understanding of that skew. Right.
Have you also looked at it versus gate voltage?
Yes. Yes. So essentially, that's right. So essentially, if we just go back to this slide over here. So if you go to if you sit at a fixed temperature, right, and you just change, so if I were to take these data over here and plot them and plot the anomalous Hall effect part as a function of rho xx in this way. So as I change the gate voltage from here to here, I'm increasing rho xx by roughly a factor of 10 or something like that. But in that same range of gate voltage, the anomalous Hall effect contribution, the RAHE, is only changing by a factor of 2 or 3 at most. Well, for that we have to go back. We have to go back to the, you know, to the other data I showed before. So that's mysterious to me.
I don't know whether you actually discussed this, but one of the things that's very interesting is, you know, if you take both the Rosen compounds, they actually have an anomalous Hall effect in the zero. It's very curious. But if you make them a thin film form, you actually get a contribution. And I'm just wondering that the, you know, whether the, you know, whether the proximity of
I can give an empirical answer to that. So there's obviously been decades of work on bulk materials of this kind, you know, diluted magnetic semiconductors, and no one has ever been able to see an anomalous Hall effect in those bulk materials. So, and that's why I ignored this idea of anomalous Hall effect, because for one thing, we've done weak localization measurements in samples like this, you know, without the magnetic ions. And spin orbit coupling for sure is extremely weak, if anything. So I think this is.
Do you have a graph of the R as a function for rho xx?
No, that's what Bert was just asking me. I don't have a graph in this slide, no. But
it's a linear or less linear?
It's sublinear. It's sublinear, right. Right. It's clearly sublinear because this is increasing by, like I said, a factor of 10, and the other one is only increasing by a factor of 2 or so. This is zinc, cadmium, manganese, selenide. There are various technical reasons for why you choose such a complicated system. But the idea is you want to make a quantum well, and that's one way that we can make a quantum well. We've done this for decades, so there's a lot in the literature. But David and I have done a lot of optical measurements on these systems, so we know the G factors, we know the Zeeman splittings, and the magnetization, this over here, was deduced by Scott Crooker from magneto PL measurements. So you know, I showed not the raw data, but I showed you the Zeeman shift. In optics, there are exciting things over here because there are Landau level crossings and you can see all sorts of interesting things.
It looks like right before it can go on to the complex that we almost are, but by extrapolating the Hall effect far on the extrapolation of the closure value. So that's just something that the.
No, but that final plateau, you mean? That last plateau is very, very broad, you have to remember. It doesn't go any. You mean in so that's the in the last slide. This is so this is the old data. This is John's data here. So this one, you know, here we tried to tailor the sample so it had less manganese and so on. You really have to go and. But even here, if I were to draw the line, it wouldn't go through this. Oh, those bumps. Okay, so people in the quantum Hall effect field, people in the quantum Hall effect field and 2D electron gases, tell me that when they have disordered systems, they often see funny stuff like that. I don't know. We've always seen these, you know, these funny kinds of things, but we don't have an explanation for that. Yeah. Well, that's what we have in our devices. I have no explanation. What is the polarization of the current? Sure, but all we know about gallium manganese arsenide is that we know that gallium manganese arsenide, based on Andreev reflection measurements, is fairly it's highly spin polarized. Whether that translates into whether I can use that number of 90% or 80%, depending on who's measured it. I mean, there's been two measurements. Peng Zhang has measured it by using planar junctions, and Boris Nadgorny has measured it using point contacts. And there are arguments about interpretations and stuff, but both of them get polarizations above 80% for sure. Right? Peng Zhang says it's about 90%. Now, how that varies with manganese composition, we've never been able to look at in great detail.
Okay.